Well, hey there, this is Endeavors. Hey, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors 2.0. On today's show, I venture out into the Vancouver International Film Festival. There's a lot of great movies, there's a lot of great stars, a lot of great people coming out, and you'll hear two interviews today and more in the coming days and weeks. On today's show, I have the star, director, and producer of the sci-fi horror film The Unseen, Julia Sarah Stone, Jeff Redknapp, and Katie Weekly, as well as you'll hear from indie film director, the Canadian godfather himself, Bruce McDonald, as well music from Farnaz Ohadi. That's all coming up on today's show. My first guests are the director, producer, and star of the sci-fi horror film The Unseen. Director Jeff Redknapp got his start in makeup and special effects, and after directing a few short films, The Unseen marks his debut feature as writer-director. And producer Katie Weekly has been with him from the beginning, both working on set as a sound person, as well as being a producer on all of Jeff's short films. She is a producer on The Unseen as well, and she was present for our conversation. And Julia Sarah Stone is one of the stars of The Unseen. In 2014, she was named a rising star at the Toronto International Film Festival for her role in the great film Wet Bum. She got her breakthrough in 2011 in the indie film The Year Dolly Parton Was My Mom. She has also appeared in the films Vampire Dog, as well as had a recurring role on season 3 of AMC's The Killing. In addition to The Unseen, she has another film in the Vancouver National Film Festival, Weirdos, directed by Bruce McDonald, as well as the short film Your Mother and I, co-starring Dawn McKellar. She's also featured in a new TV series entitled Aftermath. I spoke with Julia, Jeff, and Katie last Sunday. Here is our conversation. I am here with Julia Sarah Stone, Jeff Redknapp, and Katie Weekly, the director, producer, and star of The Unseen. Hello, folks.
Hi.
So, Jeff, I'll start with you. This is a very interesting film, and I know your background is in makeup and special effects. Where did the idea to write and direct a feature come from for you?
Well, we've Katie and I have been working up to a feature for a few years now. We both work in the local film industry and have for many years, and at a fairly early point, we just decided, hey, wait a minute, we got in this to make movies, not to just have a job. So we started focusing our efforts on writing and producing and directing shorts. And I think we did about 5 or 6 fairly serious shorts where we were drawing from all our local industry contacts and what we'd learned working on film sets. And so it was just a natural progression to a feature.
Julia, I know this was something exciting for you. You get to come do a movie that's set and shot in your hometown. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it's great. It's always really fun to get to work in Vancouver. It's kind of rare. A lot of times I'm flying to Toronto, but I've actually been all over the country filming. But yeah, it was really fun, and it was my first time doing something kind of sci-fi with lots of special effects and learning how that works. So it was really fun.
How did you find the prosthetics, or was it all special effects with the arms?
It was a lot of it was puppets.
Yeah, I mean, in the big picture, it was a combination of the visual effects, makeup effects, and animatronic puppets.
that you're just pointing to your arm. Did you mean Julia's specific invisible arm?
Well, both her and Aiden, right, had the same sort of thing going on.
The one time, yeah, the effect on Julia was a practical puppet element.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, I read somewhere that The Unseen was kind of inspired by The Invisible Man, by H.G. Wells?
Yeah, it was. I mean, in the earliest sense, it was just conceived in, we were looking to come up with a new project, something that we hadn't seen before, and we just sort of, I woke up one morning thinking about The Invisible Man. You know, I grew up on genre films and classic monster movies, but I just thought, well, we haven't seen an Invisible Man movie, so what could we do with that? And when we started developing the idea, I went back to the original source, you know, H.G. Wells' novel from, when did he write that, like 1920 or something? And, or maybe even earlier. And, you know, so I started looking at that, and we already had kind of fleshed out the story for The Unseen, but once we started looking at the original source material, it really informed where we went with the new version. And it also, surprisingly, there were a lot of connections between the two that had just naturally occurred, you know? Like the original Invisible Man, it's about a scientist who experiments on himself and becomes invisible, and then the side effects are that he develops a bit of a god complex. He becomes a megalomaniac, and he thinks he's better than everyone. He's superior to everyone, and it also feels kind of an anger. He gets violent and angry towards people, and that's his downfall. In the end, he hurts too many people, and they go after him. So, and in our story, we did develop this idea that the Bob character had anger issues. We connected it to a career in hockey that he had left behind. There were a lot of connections to the original book that just naturally happened. And the title also was inspired by the book. In the book, they refer to the condition as the unseen and the character as the unseen. They use that expression, the unseen, I think 29 times in the book. I did a search on the book. And each time it's sometimes it's different. Sometimes it's used as the character, sometimes it's the condition, sometimes it's a more of a broader thing. And when we were shooting the film, it was called something different. And partway through, Julia, when we were debating the title, she said, well, how about The Unseen? You'd also read the book, right? Yeah. So that's where we were.
Julia, you mentioned that this is sort of your first sci-fi, psychological, and I think maybe with a couple of the decades, it seems like your first really genre heavy film. Do you like? Are you a fan of sci-fi in general? Would you say?
Yeah, I really love any story that lets me see the world in a different kind of perspective, and I think sci-fi is really a lot about that. And especially this story was so. It was very much like effects and sci-fi, but it was so character-driven and story-based, and that's why I was really drawn to it. And it's like the invisibility itself became a character, and it just added a whole new layer to this already really complex story that was kind of there already. So yeah, I love the characters and the story.
Jeff, the decision to actually set the movie in Vancouver, because I've been hearing a lot of debate in the Canadian media recently about how profitable it is to set a movie or a TV series in Canada. Was that just a foregone conclusion? Like it was already something you thought you were going to do?
It was a pretty brief discussion on whether we were going to try and hide the location or be serious about it. Yeah, I mean, I think in the big commercial world, there is a fear that if you set the story somewhere specific, like Canada, it'll alienate it from other markets. I think the biggest concern is the U.S. market. Some people feel that if it's a Canadian story, you won't be able to sell it in the States. But we just came to the decision that, you know, the concept was bigger than location and it could work anywhere. And if it was going to sell in read territories like the States, it was going to be because it was a good story and well told. It wasn't going to matter that it was a Canadian. And then once we accepted it was Canadian, I think we really got behind the idea that we were trying to create potentially an iconic Canadian character. He's very much, he's a Canadian hockey player that's the new Invisible Man. And we didn't shy away from that once we got into it. We even threw a few A's into the dialogue. And actually at the beginning of the process, Aidan Young asked me, he said, do you want me to do, because he's born in Canada but raised in Australia, so his accent is kind of hodgepodge. He describes it as departure lounge. And he sounds Australian to me. So when we started, he said, do you want me to do an American accent? Do you want me to do a generic North American accent? Or do you want Canadian? And again, at that point, we kind of decided, we committed, it's going to be a Canadian story. And I said, yeah, do Canadian. But don't exaggerate it. And he found the perfect medium, and a few A's and whatnot slipped in there. Had a little bit of dialogue consulting on set about the correct Canadian way to pronounce certain words. Yeah. And he has his series shoots in Georgia, and he plays the set in Georgia. So he often found himself slipping from the Canadian accent back into his Georgian accent. He'd usually cut himself mid-take when he recognized that was happening.
Julia, for you, what was it like working with a... not a first-time director, but a director who is well versed in the genre. Does that make things easier for you?
I think it made the learning experience really really cool. And Jeff has such a great imagination and really knew the characters and what they were trying to accomplish, and that really made it easier as an actor. But also just the effects and how that all worked. It was great to watch
him work. Now, we talked a little bit before the interview in that you actually have a couple of films here in Vancouver. You have another one, Weirdos, directed by probably the godfather of indie Canadian cinema, Bruce MacDonald. How did that project come into your lap?
That was a taped audition. I put myself on tape in my living room and sent it, and I was flying to Nova Scotia and meeting everybody on the team, and it was such a great experience. Bruce is an amazing, amazing director. He's like such a teddy bear.
A very different movie, though, I would say, than The Unseen.
Yeah, it's an indie 70s road trip movie set. It's black and white, and it's just really sweet.
Have you guys seen Weirdos yet?
No,
really?
I haven't
seen it yet.
Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's really good.
We will see it.
But yeah, no, back to The Invisible Man. I mean, I think some people think, you know, when you talk about genre films, and specifically sci-fi, there is so much of it that there's a worry that it could saturate the market. Was that ever a concern for you?
Saturate the market in what sense?
Because it's like every week there's a new sci-fi film or a new project release, and so people, I mean, the sci-fi fans will always go see the sci-fi movies.
Yeah.
But I think sort of the more broader film goers might tire of the genre in a way. As a filmmaker, does that worry you at all? Is that something you think about?
Well, it's a bit tricky because it does seem like in terms of wide distribution of a genre film, there's only room for a couple of them, you know? Like, maybe once or twice a month there's excluding the big studio genre stuff, but like the smaller indie genres, the horror movies primarily, the ones that get widely distributed, there's maybe one or two a month. And as you get into the fall, maybe a few more around Halloween. But as we all know, there's a lot more than that being. And as you said, the fans will find the smaller films once they hit VOD or Netflix or whatever, and they'll appreciate it. But yeah, you are competing for a pretty narrow window of opportunity for exposing a film. In terms of whether we worried about that, I don't think so. We just sort of, we knew we were making a film that wasn't an extreme genre film. It wasn't the latest blood and guts horror. It wasn't the latest psycho killer. It was more a dramatic film with a genre vein in it. And we made the film we wanted to make and told the story we wanted to tell. And we're hoping it will find its audience somewhere.
What's it like having the film at a festival in the city in which the film is set and shot? Does that have a special meaning because it's sort of your hometown festival?
I don't know if it... I never thought of it that way. I thought of it in terms of being the hometown screening and that the cast and crew were mostly based here, and this for a lot of them it was the first time they were going to see it. I never really thought of it as being set here. I suppose for the audience, the Vancouver audience, it might be an interesting experience going to a film with, you know, such a fantasy story like The Invisible Man and seeing it play out on the streets of their own city. You know, that I could see that being an interesting experience. But from our point of view, it was more about the nerve-wracking fact that we were bringing it home to the people that had witnessed us making it and had, as I mentioned earlier somewhere else, like my colleagues at work have been hearing about this project for years. Like I've been talking about it at work, you know, ad nauseum. So for them to finally come out and see it, that was a little stressful. Like we got up and did an intro Q&A at the first screening, and I realized partway in that I was actually nervous. You kind of get used to getting up there and turn off the nerves and just do the thing, and then you realize that half the audience is people that worked on the film, people that you know, and they're all here to see it. And suddenly, I guess their response to the film matters more. It's just more personal. And I guess it's also more vulnerable, you know, because if Joe Blow somewhere and on the other side of the country didn't like your film, you just walk away from it. But if your friends and family think it disappointed, or it's, yeah.
And Julia, you're somewhat of a festival veteran. There was the big star at TIFF a couple of years ago. What's the festival experience like for you? And how does the Vancouver Festival maybe differ for some other ones because it's your hometown?
Yeah, it's great to be able to kind of tell people I know and my friends, like, hey, I've got like films at Vancouver right now. It's really exciting and it's kind of special to know that they're showing in my hometown and like Jeff said, to see where we filmed and that it's here. And for the films that I shot out of the city, it's great to have those filmmakers come here and kind of get to show them around, and yeah, it's a great experience.
And I also wanted to ask you, you have a TV series that just premiered, I think, Aftermath, which is sort of another, I guess, sci-fi series. What can you tell us about that?
It follows a family of five as the world starts to end, and it's really, really fast-paced. It's really, it's lots of action, lots of mythological creatures, but it's also very character-driven, which again is what I am really drawn to about any kind of project. So it's great to see like these characters and how they evolve and how their relationships with each other evolve, and they really are pushed to the limits by these extreme circumstances, but it's still a family dynamic, which is really cool. I don't think any other show has really done that.
Well, this film is The Unseen, and it's playing now at Vancouver International Film Festival. There's one more screening on Friday.
Friday, 4:15 at International Village.
All right. Well, Jeff, Katie, Julia, thanks so much. And that was director Jeff Radnep, producer Katie Weekly, and star Julia Sarastone of the film The Unseen. This is a song by Farnaz Ohadi. This is Bird Dance. به دریا نسیم آبان شکست ناله های موج بر سنگ شکست ناله های موج
موج برسن. مگر دریا دلی داند که ما را چه توفان هاست در این سینه تن. سپردم سینه را بر سینه کو، غریق بحت جنگل هایان بود. غروب بیش زارانم در افکند به جنگل های بی پایان اندو. به خانه مرغ مست بیشی دو گریزه در صدایت شادی و نو. قفص تنگ است و دل تنگ است ولی من هزاران نغمه دارم چون تو پرشو. دستین روح بیتا فراز از شوق هستی شور پرواز، فرودش غم سکوتش مرگ و مردان. لبه دریا غریب موج و کولا، فرو پیچید شب در باد نمنا. نگاه ما در آن تاریک، نگاه ماهی افتاده در خواب. به خانه مرغ مست بیشید و گریزد از صدایت شادی اونو. قفص تنگ است و دل تنگ است ولی من هزاران نم دارم چون تو خوشون. به خانه مرغ مست بیشید گریزد از صدایت شادی و نو. قفص تنگ است و دل تنگ است ولی من هزار چون تو پرشو. لبه دریا شب از هنگام لبریز، خروج موجها پریز پریز. نران توفان که صد فریاد گم شد، چه برمی آید از وای شبابی.
By Farnaz Ohadi. Farnaz came to Canada at age 10 from her native Iran. After studying Iranian music for many years, she became fascinated by the flamenco sounds of Spain and spent several years combining the two sounds with her musical group, Mashreg. She's now releasing her debut solo album of Persian flamenco music. Here is the conversation I had with Farnaz Ohadi. Farnaz Ohadi, hello, welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So I'm really interested. I was looking up a little bit about you, and it sort of describes you as Persian flamenco, which, a lot of people might be like, well, that's, like flamenco is Spanish, but I actually think those two types of music go really, really well together just in terms of how they sound. How did you, I know you're originally from Iran, but how did you get into studying flamenco music?
It kind of goes back to when I was little. My dad really liked flamenco a lot, so he had a couple of cassettes and he like insistently played it for us, and we kept listening to it, and he would go on and say, listen to the angst and the anxiety and the sadness and the oppression, and we were like, oh my god, dad, come on. And then until we took a trip together to southwest Spain specifically, he really wanted us to understand what's going on. And we went through the south of Spain, which is basically where now the homeland of flamenco is, all the Jerez and Sevilla. And it just hit me like a flood. It's like a ton of things hit me. Like, this is amazing. So we went to all kinds of shows, from very classical, more ballet style, to really rough and tumble and improvised versions. So I completely fell head over heels in love with flamenco and the music I love. We went back to Iran, and in Iran there was absolutely no opportunity of exploring at all. So it was just his cassettes that I took over. And until I came to Canada in 1990 was the first time that I finally had this amazing accessibility of having access to music. There was no internet then, but still then I could just go on the, I had like a stack of CDs. I still carry them around. They didn't want to go anywhere. So just immersion, just listening. And I had to deal with a lot of, new immigrant stuff. We went to Toronto first. And I sort of had a second immigration to Vancouver in 96. And when that happened and things were a little bit more stable, I actually had a job, finished school, and so on. So I felt like maybe I could actually start do something in flamenco, and that's when I started dancing in flamenco, and danced, and it was amazing. Sort of right away, I really felt really at home. And then in 2002, I've had two kids by then, and I felt that I couldn't really take as many dance classes as I could, so I looked for something else, and singing seemed like a natural fit, although at the time I had a lot of questions and doubts, because I'm not, obviously not Spanish, not native Spanish speaker. I didn't feel like it was my culture, it was an adopted thing. So I went to one of my amazing teachers here. He's an amazing singer himself and a really well-known flamenco dancer, Oscar Nieto. And I told him, some of these questions that I have, and I'm really driven. I want to sing. And do you think it's okay? And he said, flamenco is for everyone. And I said, well, I'm from Iran, what do you think? And he's like, this doesn't matter. Just do what you need to do, because it's not for everyone. But if you're feeling driven, you should do it. So it became sort of this dance of imitation for a long time. The closest I would sing to the original songs that I would pick up and I liked, the better accomplished I felt. But it was always this little nuance of how good could I imitate. Until sort of came to head again around 2012, feeling that, the tickle of wanting to do something more, feeling that, it was still, yes, it was great, but what about my own stuff? Like, what about my art? And I felt that I've done long enough, spend enough time in flamenco that I could really maybe start thinking of making my own. Or I had the option of going to Spain, and I didn't really want to do that because my family's here. So that was the first time that I thought, okay, so what if I do something that neither the Spaniards can do and neither the Iranians can do? I can do something that Canadian can do, because I've lived here, been immersed in flamenco culture. I'm from Iran, and I was there long enough to really remember the language and the culture. So what if I put them together? And that was the very first time that the idea came that maybe I should combine them. And there were a couple of artists around the world and here and even in Vancouver who were exploring with the same ideas of particularly Persian music and flamenco music. But what I've seen so far is that they're mostly side by side, when there's like a group of musicians sit sort of on either side, and then a virtuoso, a singer, a Persian singer sings, and then flamenco singer sings, and it sort of overlaps. There's conversations. I wanted one voice. which that sort of began, was the beginning of this journey of understanding how the language could possibly work in the rhythms of flamenco. The language in Farsi is very soft. It's very melodic. If you have buddies, you must know. It's like singing. But the Spanish, it tends to really work well with the cortes and all the little offbeats and in the nuances of flamenco music. So you don't have to break the music, the words as much apart. So I had to go back one by one and dissect all these lyrics that I really wanted to say, but to stay true to the words so they were understandable, but I was still delivering the rhythms that I was interested in. So it took a long time to get there.
And how did the album Bird Dance, how was that born?
It sort of came out of a concert that I did with Liron in 2014. That was the first time that we presented some of these songs, a couple of other things, in a concert format, in a formal way. So we really worked on them. And then once we presented them, they were received really well. And people felt like, you know, this was great. We had a local dancer, really famous dancer here locally, and she managed them. So that for the first time, I felt like, you know, there is really something here. Then I started really thinking of what is it that I'm trying to say? And I realized that I do have certain songs that trace the stories that I really have been sort of dealing with, all the issues that I've been dealing with all my life since I've come to Canada and before that. So a frame of a four-covered album seemed like it was there. It just needed to sort of put in pieces. And I have a lot of material. Only 8 are presented here. One of them is, in fact, even not me, it's the instrumental piece. So it's only 7 of all my songs. I have about 25, 30 songs. So I felt like this was an opportunity to do this, but we didn't feel ready. So between the two of us, he went to Spain and I stayed here. And that's when I really started working with a local Persian singer here to understand the traditional forms of Persian music, as well as not to sacrifice the words. So I was singing to her and she's like, I didn't understand that word. Do it differently. So the accent had to be adjusted. So the sacrifice, like this dance, this in between that you have to find, okay, how do I sing this word? It's understandable, but however, flamenco is also, you know, that was really the biggest challenge musically for me. And and I think it's working now. So then we felt like that's a good time to start recording.
And I know you're quite well known here in the busking community. What just being a busker in Vancouver, what's that experience like?
Well, I don't know if I would. I mean, I'm not a street busker because flamenco, it's difficult to bus because there's usually a guitarist. The guitarist tends to be louder than the voice, and there's this dancer that's louder than both of us. So, you know, unless you're amped, it's difficult to really perform outside. I do a lot of gigs, though, like maybe we could call them mostly that because they're local cafes. And I just have to kind of take it aside here that the only city in all of Canada that has an overflow of places to perform at is Vancouver. Not even Toronto and Montreal that have really vibrant flamenco communities have places that you can get flamenco Tuesday now, as at Cabrito, Tuesday to Sunday. There's flamenco, live flamenco. And there's all these schools that make it work and all these dancers and musicians that come around. So extremely vibrant. So when I started singing, because I had the background with dancing, I took to performing almost right away. Because what I do love the most is the improv aspect of flamenco. And because I knew the dance, it was really easy to read the signs. And I was able to pick up on signals from the dancer, when to pull away, when to start singing. The guitarist could follow me. So it was a natural fit to start performing. And again, it was in Spanish. So people reacted as if I was just singing what they knew. And then since 2012, when I started doing this, every once in a while, I sort of just break into the Farsi versions of the same formats, and the dancers don't even blink. They just keep going doing their thing. And in some of the gigs that I've done, I spotted like a big table of Persians. And when I sort of switch the language and I hear them, they kind of go, What? And they turn around, and the entire table sort of turns around, they tune into the music, and they get up, and they're quite excited that for the first time, flamenco is actually speaking to them directly. But the dancers, they just move on as if it's, because it is flamenco at the end of the day. It is what they know. The forms are very traditional. So
we were talking a little bit before about world music and sort of the concept of world music. And Vancouver is a very multicultural city.
Yes.
But it strikes to me that as much as it is world music, it's Canadian music.
Yes.
How do you find that, you know, as a musician, everyone is trying to define it, you know, define what it is you do and put you into like a certain category, if you will?
Well, I think they will have a really hard time dealing with me in here, because I have been asked that question a lot, not just by people in the media, just regular people. So who's your audience? And I really don't know. Because if you're Persian but you don't know flamenco, it kind of doesn't make sense. If you're a flamenca and you know flamenco, then the language is different. That still doesn't make sense. So it's overall an expression of music, and it seems this particular album seems to connect because it has everything for everyone. The box, if it needs to happen, it will happen. I'm not after to label myself anything in particular. This was something that came very much from inside me. It was never intended for a particular audience or a particular, you know, goal per se, to make lots of money or to bring fame. It just needed to be done. It's completely a, you know, something therapeutic that needed to be done. And you know, from one artist to another, the contentment that I feel now, I've never felt in all my 40 years. As an artist, to say that is a lot, because artists are never content. They're like constantly like, what else? I could fix it. I can make it better. It's not done. But I feel so relaxed. I feel like, oh my God, it's like Harry Potter's, you know, pensive. It's like, done, done. Oh my God. I'm like, oh yeah. And it's a good feeling. It's a good place to be. So it doesn't matter what box you need to put it in. It's done. It's good. I'm happy. You do whatever you want to do with it. It's out there. It's going to do its own thing. Yeah. And you know, just to kind of touch a little bit on the world-class idea of Vancouver in particular, in all the, especially in the last 5-6 years, I've noticed the range and the quality of musicians that have actually called Vancouver home is mind-blowing. Like, I go to sessions where, you know, I sort of jam with this dude who plays, like, you know, gypsy violin. I'm like, oh, wow, you're so good, let's play. And then his time comes up, and then this horde of fans come and they're like, do you know who this guy is? They're like, I don't know who he is, and he's really famous in his world. This happens in Gypsy Romania music, Persian music, Davide Sampaolo with Italian, incredible, and he's actually on the album, but I'm biased, but he's an incredible world-class percussionist. The people, when they hear he's here, they can't believe it. I mean, I can name all these people that are incredible artists, and they just happen to live in Vancouver. And honestly, when you think of it that way, this is as Canadian as it gets. This album, if you had to put it in a box, I would put it in very much a Canadian album. No other place in the world I would have been able to just not think about any of these things and just say, I want to do this. And people are like, okay, cool, let's hear what you got.
Yeah.
You know, it's perfectly okay to come up with this mishmash of thing. And it's like, yeah, cool, let's go, let's hear it, right?
The album is Bird Dance, and I encourage all the listeners to check it out. Farnaz Ohadi, thank you so much.
Oh my God, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that was my conversation with Farnaz Ohadi. Here's another song off her album Bird Dance. This is Santur Solo. That was Santur Solo by Farnaz Ohadi. My final guest is somewhat of an icon in the world of independent film in Canada. His previous directing and credits include Trigger, The Husband, and the iconic Hardcore logo. He recently teamed up with screenwriter and friend Daniel McIver for a lovely little coming-of-age film set in the 1970s called Weirdos. He is Bruce McDonald, and I had a chance to speak with him at the Vancouver International Film Festival just a little while ago.
Yeah, I really love this film, and I'm curious how you became involved in the project. Did Daniel just phone you up one day and say, hey, I have a new project. Do you want to direct it?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, I worked with Daniel on a couple of other projects, so we have a good kind of thing going. And I think the one before this, I had sort of pitched to him. I said, hey, let's make a story about this. So this, I was kind of like his turn. So I was like, he's like, hey, man, I got this idea. And he pitched me like a sentence or two. And I said, yeah, I like that. And he's fast. So from I like that to reading a first draft of the script was, I think, about, I don't know, it seemed like 3 weeks. It was pretty fast. And then I liked it a lot because I said, okay, let's build this. Let's make this happen. So off we went.
And you've worked with Dana before, and I know you've also worked with Dylan and with Molly and a couple others, I think.
Alan Hocko I just met, but Daniel McIver had worked with Alan on different things. And Kathy Jones I had met once before. Julia Sarah Stone, I had just met her on this. So, yeah, it was some family stuff. And I was the new guy. We shot it out in Nova Scotia. So it was, you know, a lot of them knew each other. And I was accepted into the family.
But what's that like for you, you know, working with people, you know, again, that you already have this professional relationship with?
Well, it was great. I mean, in this case, because Dylan plays the young lead guy in the film, you know, there's issues in the film of sexual identity and there's some touchy things. And because we'd had an experience together, we'd worked together, there was a kind of, you know, it's a shorthand. So there's more than that. There's trust, right? So you know that you could probably handle any crisis that comes along pretty much, hopefully. And with Molly, I've known Molly since pretty much her first film. We'd worked together on this series called Twitch City, which is really hilarious. Daniel was also in that. So, you know, when you come back together, it comes back to that simple thing of trust and honesty. And Molly, I remember when she finished the shooting of this, she says, you know, I haven't had this much fun for a long time. And she was so, that sort of family vibe gave her that kind of bravery to just go for it. Right. And she was a little bit nervous at the beginning, like thinking, oh, am I doing too much? Or is this, I said, no. Like you. And she did such a magnificent job. And part of that comes from her comfort and trust with Daniel and myself. And it was just pretty a treat.
You know, the film does deal a lot with the idea of, you know, sexuality and sexual identity. And we're seeing a lot of films and a lot of sort of creative projects that are about that theme and you know, in that area. Why do you think it is that now seems to be the time where so much of what we watch and what we read surrounds the idea of identity and sexuality?
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. I have noticed that myself. And, you know, you sometimes think of what zeitgeist are we in or what's going on when we look back at this time, say 20, 30 years from now, what will it be? And I know sort of, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, we would look back at sort of the civil rights movements of, you know, the racial strife, and especially in America, as something that was a big unifying factor for liberal people and people wanting to improve society, wanting to make things better. And I almost think that this sort of, you know, this the efforts that have been made and the struggle of, call it this sexual identity situation, is akin to that kind of struggle of, you know, civil rights to a degree in some way. And I don't know why this is the time, or, you know, if it had, maybe it should have come earlier, maybe it would have come later for some reason, I'm not sure. But yeah, I think about that often, and I'm not sure why that is. But I know my daughter, who's 13, you know, she has a clear and compassionate and great empathy for people that are different, people's sexuality, not only just gay and lesbian, but transgender people and people struggling with, you know, if they're struggling, but, you know, way more than I do, way more than I, you know, and it's kind of impressive to see that there's a evolution in a kind of some kind of consciousness of not maybe everybody, but it's growing for sure. And it's a very impressive thing to see in young people.
I think the other part of identity that really strikes me about this film is how Canadian it is. And,
oh, yeah.
And I do see that a lot in a lot of the films that you've made. There's something very Canadian about a lot of them. What is the Canadian identity to you?
I think it is being kind of a weirdo or being outside of things, outside of the center. As Canadians, we're very much outside of the center, say, of Europe and America. We always feel like say you grew up in Toronto, you know, you always think, oh, there's a better party going on in New York. You're always thinking of what's downtown and the crazier things that are sort of out in the void, out in the wilderness. So there's a kind of a, I don't know, maybe there's a broader curiosity of, you know, what is traditional and, I don't know, for, you know, Canadians sit on the line where they can see into the center and they can see out to the void, the fringes, and they get the benefit of both. Whereas if you're in the dead center, it's rare that you kind of feel the fringes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're in the fringes, you're just so far from the center, it doesn't even count. But I don't, you know, I've worked all over this country in a great way. And I mean, it's hard to say if what's that defining quality of Canadians. And I think Andy Warhol's kind of comment in the movie where he talks about your flag is a leaf. It's just a leaf. You're all kind of weirdos, which is a good thing. So there's a sort of a pride in difference. There's a pride in, you know, letting people be a little eccentric, maybe. I don't know.
The one thing I was fascinated by was the decision to shoot in black and white. How early on in the filmmaking process did you come to that decision, and what brought it on?
It came late in the process. Daniel and I were talking one day about I don't know, whatever, we were talking about script things, and we were talking about that time traveling of, like, we're going back to 1976. In a small movie like this, there's not a lot of resources for production values, like, you know, and having a lot of set dressing and a lot of items in the frame that will take you back there, or wardrobe. We had just enough to kind of create that illusion. But we thought, well, black and white tells you right away that it's not contemporary necessarily. Well, sorry, it's contemporary, but it seems like a memory to me. It seems like something remembered or something in the past. So it was a kind of a shorthand, I think, to kind of help take us back to the past.
And I think the other thing that's really evident that's in the past is the idea of Andy Warhol as a spirit animal. You know, the film takes place in 1976. What do you think Andy Warhol represented for that generation, you know, for the time period that the film is set in?
I think Andy Warhol, probably, you know, similar to what he represents today, I think. And for that generation, it was the sort of the outsider, you know, somebody working outside outside the establishment and becoming extremely successful and very well regarded. Even in his own lifetime, he was, you know, celebrated and, you know, he was controversial. He did things, but that were strange to people. But I think for young people, artists, people finding their way, he was just such a beacon because he was sort of unabashedly, you know, unafraid to sort of be weird or be a pop artist. He was,
You know, he had this factory, they talk about in the movie. Oh, he has this factory. He calls his friends superstars. He lives, you know, in this cool place, and they do art, and he makes movies, and he's... And I got to tell you, I knew a little bit about Warhol, but having done this movie and dug into his projects and his kind of the book that our hero brings on the journey, The Philosophy of Andy Warhol, I recommend to anybody. Doesn't matter if you're into Andy Warhol or not, but it's a fantastic book of hilarious kind of comments on, you know, fame, art, love, sex, whatever. And it's very enlightening and funny.
Do you see anybody like that today who maybe stands for what Andy Warhol stood for? Is there anybody like that today that you think that can be that model for young people?
I mean, in certain ways. I mean, I'm a big fan of like Lady Gaga, you know, and I think somebody like her who kind of pushes sort of sexual identity and makes, you know, pretty intense, crazy videos and considers her kind of seems to sort of live her life as a living art project, which was similar to Andy Warhol's notion. I mean, I love Andy Warhol's notion of like his attention and his fascination with nothingness and absence and space. He was more interested in an empty room than the things in it. So in terms of specifically Andy Warhol type of things, no, but there, you know, like Banksy, for example, I think is a great sort of a modern sort of Warholian pop artist that has playing with the idea of celebrity by not being there, you know, and I think that's a great similar but different kind of equation to a pop artist now doing something that challenges our notions of, you know, art as commerce and pop art and political and sexual. Yeah, it's cool.
You know, it's funny you mentioned Gaga because in so many of your movies, music plays a very big role, and I think Weirdos is no different. You've got the reference to Edward Bear.
Yeah.
And that really seems to be the music focal point, but there's others as well. When you go about, you know, making a film, how early on in the process does sort of your idea of what music you want come into it?
Often early. I mean, often at the script stage, there's often ideas as you're conjuring this world. And it's really fun because it kind of helps power you through the most difficult stage, I think, of the filmmaking process, which is the script writing, is the document, the architecture, the rhythms, the patterns. So I've always found music inspiring, helps keep you going, helps you from being sort of bummed out at how long things take, and it just kind of gives you those little jet engines. So in this case, Daniel was part of that as the writer, and you know, we were both about the same age at that time. So I'd say half the songs in the movie were kind of conceived of at the script stage. You know, the Marie McLaughlin song at the end, the Patsy Gallant song from New York to L.A. What else? A few of the other songs. I think the Stampeders song. So yeah, it's lovely to sort of begin with them and have them carry you through to the end.
A lot of Canadiana. And it is well. Is that important to you as a Canadian filmmaker to include sort of to promote your country's music in a way?
A little bit. I mean, the thinking with this was that America's on TV and Canada's on the radio, and this wasn't long after the CRTC mandated that radio stations had to play a certain amount of Canadian music, and that gave birth to an incredible still thriving, I hope, music industry, and gave birth to all kinds of terrific artists and musicians. So, you know, this was a kind of beginning of something in the 70s, that kind of flourishing of the musical world. So I felt proud of that, and all that music meant a lot to me. I mean, if I lived in Ohio, I would probably make films about Ohio, you know, or America. You kind of, you know, as an independent filmmaker, you kind of use what's around you. You use what you have. And you tend to kind of, I can't help but sort of reflect the places that these stories happen. Sometimes I'm drawn to these stories. Like, for example, in Vancouver, I was drawn to Michael Turner's book, Hardcore Logo. I'm not from, you know, the West, but that book spoke to me deeply in terms of the characters that I run into. And so that became about this place, Vancouver, and that sort of classic Western tour that so many bands go through. I'm happy, you know, Daniel took me to the East. I'm not growing up there, but you realize that the more specific you are in some of these stories, the more universal it becomes, because every culture has its kind of weirdnesses and its specificnesses, and that's sort of fascinating to people. For us, it might be nostalgic. For other people in Japan, it just might be, you know, surreal, or it might be, you know, beautifully exotic and strange.
I actually think one of the benefits of an indie film like yours is you actually get to shoot the film in the location where it's set.
Mm.
A lot of the bigger budget productions you won't see that. But was that something that you knew right away you were going to do?
Yeah, I mean, you cheat a little bit, but for the most part, yeah, we were there and we made the trip, and that's part of the draw too for the crew. You know, the little crew that came along. It's like, oh, we're going on a little adventure, right? We're going to go to these places. And it was important. I know what you mean, because, you know, a lot of projects that are even much bigger, they, you know, suddenly instead of going to Chicago, they'll shoot Toronto for Chicago. Instead of going to, you know, Venice, they'll green screen it, or but there's something amazing about sort of being in the place itself, because there are certain details, like the faces on the gas station attendant that you just sort of see in the background. It's very particular to that place, you know?
Yeah.
And just the strange little details. So sometimes that independence and that kind of small box that you work within, you don't have the money that sort of bigger shows have, but it does give you that quickness and nimbleness to kind of, you know, you're like a little commando unit that can leap about, rather than the bigger army of 150 people that's a lot more logistically kind of almost impossible to leap about and get that.
Have you ever had a desire to do something really, really big budget?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, growing up, you know, most of the movies that I saw were, you know, huge movies, and I still love those movies. And, you know, I'll go see the new Star Trek, I'll go see the new whatever. You know, it's just fine. It's just knowing the material and the timing. I remember reading a book lately, a series of books by Margaret Atwood called Works in Crake, which is this incredible, amazing, it's a 3-book series that's set in the near future. And I was like, I want to make this. But, you know, it's a $100 million production. And I think Darren Aronofsky got his hands on it, and HBO is doing it as this kind of incredible thing. So, okay, well, at least my instincts are good. And one of these days, yeah. I mean, it's just time and money. It doesn't change it that much. It's just like people get paid more. You get to shoot longer. You get to, you know, you get to kind of use a few more toys, and you get to work with famous actors and talented people. So it's not that different from, you know, it's a bit more, you know. So, yeah, one of these days.
It's funny. I actually had a chance to speak with Julia yesterday about her other project that
right.
She has going on here. But you've worked with young actor actors a lot. What is that process like for you, working with sort of people of that age who are maybe a generation removed from you?
It's always fun. It's always a pleasure, because, you know, you're kind of learning about their world, and there's this, I don't know, there's a freshness, there's an openness to that. And then here and there you discover things you have in common. I remember working with Ellen Page, and she was about 17, I guess, and we met for the first time, and you're always a bit nervous no matter who it is or what age they are. And then our common link was our mutual love of Patti Smith. And I was like, oh, that's so cool that you know who that is, or you celebrate her music. And, you know, so eventually you find your common ground. You find the thing that makes you laugh together, or the thing that, and being young people, you know, there's always like all these great things. You can say, man, if you like this, you're going to love this. So there's always a little bit of like, I'll slip a few records or a few books to say, yeah, you're going to love this when the time comes to read it. So I don't know. I mean, maybe it's that sort of story. I thought about it too myself. I don't know. Maybe it's that it's the time of your life when these stories, these certain stories are so amazing. Like you're kind of coming into the world sort of for the first time when you're kind of a mid late teens. And, you know, there's a few stories that we're still to tell that we're working on that are like, yeah, that's, there's about a couple of teenage kids and, but I can't get away from it. It's like, I just find it sort of a fascinating time of life, I guess. And, I don't know. So, yeah. And it's fun. They're not jaded. They're not bitter. They don't, you know, they're not, don't have a coke habit yet. And, you know, it's all good.
Well, the film is Weirdos. I very much enjoyed it. And Bruce McDonald, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Yeah. Thank you for taking the time to talk. Yes.
That was my conversation with Canadian film director Bruce McDonald. That does it for me today. On Friday, we're going to be taking a one-episode break from our VIFF interviews to bring you a conversation with Athena Russell and Tiara Sulik of Bitch Pop Productions, as well as author Anosh Irani and singer-songwriter Jake Bug. We're going to take you out with Stars from Farnaz Ohadi. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
شب یک سر شوق و شورم از این عالم گویی دورم ماما پروین سخنی گویم از روی من اثری جویم جان یابم زین شب شاف دارم نغمه ای بر لبا نغمه ای بر لبا
در سر شوری دارم، امشب در دل نوری دارم، باز امشب در اوج آسمان روزی باشم با ستارگانم. سری جویم جان یا بمزین شب ها، جان یا بمزین شب ها، ما حضور را به طربارم از خود بی خبرم، ز شف دارم شوری دارم، امشب در دل